Good evening, this is Kevin Slaughter, sitting in for David Harris at Satanism Today on the APEC Radio Network. David Harris is experiencing technical difficulties with his studio and will be back as soon as possible. This show has been pre-recorded, but I will do my best to be in the APEC chat room for discussion during the show, barring unforeseen circumstances. I hope everybody had a good Halloween, and I wanted to say, but because a show has been pre-recorded, items that I discuss during the podcast may change. I also want to add that I am a representative of the Church of Satan, but not all of the things that I will discuss here necessarily represent the philosophy of Satanism or the Church of Satan as an organized religious body. With that caveat, let's get on with the show. The previous show, in part, was going to be discussing the recent judgment against the Westboro Baptist Church, and David Harris made a blog post about it. So, in keeping up with the spirit of the show and the fact that it's significantly part of his thoughts, I'm going to read his recent blog post about it for you. It's titled, Why the Westboro Baptist Church Judgment is Wrong, by David Harris, read by Kevin Slaughter. Make no mistake about it, the Westboro Baptist Church is a disgusting, hate-mongering organization on par with the KKK. But they, like everyone else, have the right to stage a legal protest. And this ruling is nothing more than a government sanction against their right to free speech in the United States. An anti-homosexual protest at the funeral of a soldier who died honorably for his country is not only asinine, it's morally repulsive to anyone with any sense of intelligence and decency. But it's not illegal. It's protected speech. I've had more than one conversation with Shirley Phelps Roper, and while she is a hideous human being, she's not stupid. She is a lawyer, and many of her relatives that are also involved in the WBC are also lawyers. One thing that they know is the law, and they've been very careful throughout their existence not to violate it during their protests. This ruling is nothing more than a knee-jerk reaction to what many perceive to be hate speech. The one reason free speech advocates are not as up in arms as they normally be is because, well, who in their right mind would defend the WBC? Well, I suppose I'm not in my right mind this morning because I am standing up and defending the WBC's right to be bigoted idiots. I do so for two reasons. One, the government endorsed sanctions, and that's what it is, don't kid yourselves, against anyone's right to free speech in this country is a violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. Two, if such a ruling is not overturned, and I'm confident it will be, it can have dangerous implications on the future of free speech in this country. Remember, folks, people exercising their right to free speech in this country works to further stratification of the populace at large. Without it, it's one less tool in our toolbox. Think about that the next time something like this occurs. What of course is always ironic, and this is me speaking again, is every time the media does a story about the Westboro Baptist Church, they always show them during protest with their signs that say, God hates America, God hates fags, fag troops, etc., etc. They plug their website, God hates America, God hates fags. And just as I'm doing now, but Satanism Today is not a major media source. We're not repeating these messages to thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people at a time. And that's the point. That is what Westboro Baptist Church's point is, to get their message out that they believe that God, their Christian God, hates fags. And let's be honest, he does. The Christian God does hate fags. They are speaking truth to power in the leftist jingo, just as Ann Coulter does when she tells Donnie Deutsch that she wishes he would become a perfected Jew by accepting Jesus Christ. This is in line with Christianity and the worldview that the Christian Bible promotes. There is no hypocrisy here. It's actually the people in the mainstream media, many of whom would self-identify as Christians, who find shock and horror in it, but they are hypocrites. There are many levels to this debate with the Westboro Baptist Church, but the main concern I see is that most Christians are hypocrites who do not apply their Bible to their lives. They only do it when it's convenient, and they scoff at those who are orthodox. And orthodoxy just means people who take their religion seriously. Now, it is stupid, but it is the way they should be practicing their faith. In fact, Westboro Baptist Church goes pretty easy because I have not yet seen them stone anybody to death. So even the Westboro Baptist Church is pretty liberal in their application of Christian doctrine. Now, from one controversy to another, I wanted to call out another podcaster on their knee-jerk reaction to a discussion of the recent race and IQ controversy dealing with Nobel laureate James Watson. But first, I want to give you a little bit of background on the situation. If you're listening to this on a podcast, go ahead and pause it, and if you're at your computer, search up James Watson's biography in Wikipedia and get a little background on him, and then come back to listening to the podcast. For those of you listening to this pre-recorded show live, I want to go through briefly the background of this specific controversy, and you can go find out about James Watson later. In an interview with the London Times on October 14th, James Watson stated that he was, quote, inherently gloomy about the prospect of Africa, because, quote, all our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says, not really. Now, he's on a book tour, or he was on a book tour, for his new book, Avoid Boring People, a memoir. In his book, he states this, quote, there is no firm reason to anticipate that the intellectual capacities of peoples geographically separated in their evolution should prove to have evolved identically. Our wanting to reserve equal powers of reason as some universal heritage of humanity will not be enough to make it so. Because he challenged the idea of the blank slate equalitarian concept, He was lambasted in the media universally. The Science Museum in London, who had a sold-out lecture by him, canceled that lecture. And they said, quote, we know that eminent scientists can sometimes say things that cause controversy, and the Science Museum does not shy away from debating controversial topics. However, the Science Museum feels that Nobel Prize winner James Watson's recent comments have gone beyond the point of acceptable debate, and we are, as a result, canceling his talk at the museum, unquote. Beyond the point of acceptable debate is how they characterize his statement that not every group of humans is equal. You can't talk about it. He is basically saying that Africans have a lower average IQ than people of European descent, and I'm sure he would say people of Asian descent have a higher average IQ than Europeans. And as we'll hear later in the show, another science posits that Ashkenazi Jews have an even higher average IQ. He's not saying that all Africans have an IQ of 70. He's not saying that there aren't very high IQ Africans. The IQ spread out along a continuum, and when they're plotted out, they form a bell curve. And most Africans and most Europeans and most any kind of group, you group males, females, they cluster around a certain average. And a majority of the population falls, somewhere around that. To cut this kind of intro, the background, a little short, I can leave it up to you to look up bell curves if you're not familiar with them, and you can do some research on the IQ controversy if it's of further interest to you after this podcast. I also don't care to get into proving that race does or does not exist, or that IQ does or does not exist. I'm not a scientist. There is tons of data out there for you to look at. What I am going to do is talk about the reaction from a specific podcaster. And their reaction is indicative of a lot of the other responses from major media sources. So we'll get into that now. In the podcast titled Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, on October 17th, there was a short discussion on the subject. I believe it was Steve Novella who spoke at length about the topic and did a decent job, but his views were not exactly reflective of the science, as I understand it, at least not from an objective viewpoint. He did a lot of hedging. He is an MD, and I'm sure is very knowledgeable on the subject. Listen to the podcast itself for his views. It's episode 117. It's A Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The reason I'm discussing their podcast and the subject at hand is because a female co-host, Rebecca Watson, decided that she wanted to make her beliefs on the subject absolutely clear during the podcast, and she inferred that her views were those of all of the other co-hosts. The show's hosted like by four or five people. I offer you here three excerpts of her comments from that show. Rebecca runs the Skeptic blog at skeptic.org. It's referred to as an online magazine focused on women and critical thinking.
Steve, you know, it's an interesting intellectual exercise to go over things like that, and I think it's great. But I think we do need to be clear in the fact that James Watson is a racist kook, because he doesn't say things that are backed up by science. He says things and backs them up with people who have to deal with black employees find this not to be true, meaning people are the idea that people are equal is found to not be true. Because people with black employees find that's so ridiculously racist, and he says things like this all the time.
Now, she specifically states that his views are not backed up by science. That's a pretty bold statement. Here's clip number two.
You know, it's an interesting intellectual exercise to pick out what the little kernel of truth that he accidentally drops in here and there.
Yeah.
But let's keep a good perspective here and just come out and say that he is so very wrong and he has no evidence to back up his claims.
Yes, let's do that. Let's just go ahead and claim that there is no science to back up this man's claims. Let's just be complete hypocrites and do what we're accusing him of doing and make a blanket statement without supporting facts. Good work.
You know, just call him an idiot and a bigot and
right. I mean, he's how old? He's going to die soon.
Yeah.
I mean.
And then Steve Novella chimes in. Yes, let's just call him an idiot and a racist. And, well, he's going to die soon. She finds solace in the fact that James Watson will be dying soon. Since she is making such a crass, biased statement by saying the world will be better off when this racist kook is dead, I'd like to suggest that his life has benefited humanity more than this woman ever has and ever will. Of course, I don't know her personally, but I've got $5 if someone can prove me wrong. Call me on it. Prove me wrong. The first rule of the prideful is to make an exhibition of piety and charity with a good guy badge to pin to his lapel. Man cannot progress one step further towards his own godhood until he removes that good guy badge. Anton LaVey from The Devil's Notebook. This is a perfect example of a good guy badge. The key to my gripe is that this woman is co-host of a show called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. She calls herself Skeptchick, and she should have just been quiet on the matter because her commentary was the opposite of scientific skepticism. They were more doctrinarian, less critical thinking, more argumentum ad hominem. James Watson is considered by many to be one of the most important key figures in biology in the 20th century. They pose as pro-science and then dismiss him as a racist kook. And to do that is a greater disservice to the advancement of science than the feared religious right can ever do. They have dogpiled the man and kicked him when he was down. Her comments add to the suppression of scientific inquiry. James Watson knows genetics. To question that is to question the ability of anyone to know anything about anything. To say that he can make any statement associated with genetics and it be based on no science at all is to show your own stupidity, not his. And if it's not your stupidity or ignorance, it is showing your clear politically or socially motivated bias. Now, this doesn't mean that he can't say something wrong. Certainly, he can. But am I, or Skeptchick, or almost every journalist who has weighed in with their personal bias qualified in any way to really call bullshit on him? The answer is an unequivocal no. Not only no, but hell no. Skeptchick's remarks on the show are particularly reactionary, and they're featured here because they are so easily accessible in an MP3 format downloaded onto my computer. If you want to compare James Watson's words and those of the Skeptic's Guide co-host to the following selection of a talk given by John Entine, the author of Abraham's Children, Race, Identity, and the DNA of the Chosen People. It was given at the American Enterprise Institute on Monday, October 29th. Compare what James Watson said, what they said, and what this scientist says.
Now, we move into the controversial area. Other than understanding identity, what are the implications of this? I talked when I started about the medical issues that are raised, issues of behavior, issues of intelligence. This was raised in rather stark relief. A couple of years ago, a few of us, Charles and I, for instance, are on a mailing list of people who are interested in issues on human biodiversity. And about 4 or 5 years ago, two Christian scientists, Henry Harpending, and who's a very, very renowned geneticist from the University of Utah, and Gregory Cochran, who's a physicist but brilliant in a lot of areas, among them his understanding of genetics, started doing some research and came up with a theory of the genetic basis for Jewish intelligence. We know that Jews have among the highest IQ of any population group. That is absolutely clear. Jewish IQ. Ashkenazi Jews. I will. Yeah, very good. Thank you for the correction. Ashkenazi Jews. The IQ of Ashkenazi, with the average IQ, let's say, would be about 100. Ashkenazi Jews in various tests test out between 107 and about 115, but they're particularly high as an average of about 122 on the verbal scale. Good lawyers. Good joke tellers. Is this genetic? Is there a biological basis to it and a genetic basis to it? Is it only cultural? Obviously, these things are very, very controversial issues. I don't think any scientist, any geneticist or psychometrician would doubt that there's a genetic basis to IQ at this point, despite some of the debates that we hear in the popular media and the popular press about this. But again, the reasons for this, we don't really know at this point. I'll get to one of the explanations, but I just want to give you an idea of how important IQ is in success in life. If the average IQ is 100, you look at various things that could happen in life. So, for instance, lives in poverty. 30% of people with a 70 IQ live in poverty. Only 2% of people with a 130 IQ live in poverty. Obviously, there's a cultural, there's a cultural reinforcement of these kinds of factors. So this doesn't necessarily suggest that it's all genetic, but it indicates the incredible power of DNA. If you look at ever incarcerated, 7% with an IQ of 70, 0% an IQ at 130. Of course, that's incarcerated for criminal felonies. I can't imagine it's really 0%. This is a chart that was put out by the New York Times. Chronic welfare, 31%, 0% for 130 and above. So IQ is incredibly predictive of success in life. It's not only predictive of how well you'll do in college, it's predictive of how successful you'll be. And it could be one of the explanations, high IQ, for why Jews overachieve in so many areas, among Nobel laureates, winners of chemistry prizes, mathematic prizes, number of professorships in academia, a wide range of things.
Now, clearly he is discussing the connection between race and IQ. Here he's talking about Ashkenazim Jews and not blacks or whites. But obviously he's comparing Ashkenazim Jews to other race groups. His statement, good lawyers, good joke tellers. This is the same type of anecdotal comment as Dr. Watson's, if you ever had to deal with a black employee. It's not science, but it is an expression of common experience. It's what an anecdote is for. I've had this common experience myself with both slow-witted black employees and verbally quick Ashkenazim Jews. For a fairly easy-to-access representation of this, I'd recommend watching an episode of Being Bobby Brown and The Daily Show back-to-back. You'll laugh the whole time, but for very different reasons. You can find a recording of the full discussion at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy's Research's website, aei.org. It's listed under Events. These quotes from Watson and Entine do reflect popularly held stereotypes. It's true. John Stewart is a very clever man, no matter what I think of his politics, and I would not want to face him in a debate. Formerly famous Bobby Brown is an imbecile, a wife beater, a drug addict, and he has an overflated sense of entitlement. They are both very real people reflecting stereotypes. Since we're discussing racial stereotypes in the media, I would like to include here a little digression about magical Negroes. Rush Limbaugh had an extensive amount of fun with the term when an opinion piece written by a black man was published in the Los Angeles Times with the line, quote, "It's clear that Obama is also running for an equally important unelected office in the province of the popular imagination, the magic Negro." A stock character in movies, television, literature, etc., it is sometimes referred to as the mystical Negro, magic Negro, or our magical African-American friend. The term was popularized by Spike Lee, according to Wikipedia, who, at Washington State and Yale, derided the archetype of the super-duper magical Negro. Now, I'm not sure from this reading of the Wikipedia entry if he has a problem with the mystical Negro by itself, or just the super-duper magical Negro. That aside, Both the concepts of race and intelligence are hotly debated, though the reality of both are obvious to the common observer. Because something seems obvious doesn't make it so. I'm not saying that. But as a materialist who values a real-world empirical understanding of the reality of the world, I don't immediately reject my own understanding of the world because someone has provided an alternative hypothesis, however cleverly phrased it may be. I can be convinced and change my mind, but none of these scenarios actually make or change the objective nature of reality. A good definition of intelligence was published in the Wall Street Journal on December 13, 1994. Quote, intelligence is a very general mental capability that, among other things, involves the ability to reason, plan, solve problems, think abstractly, comprehend complex ideas, learn quickly, and learn from experience. It is not merely book learning, a narrow academic skill, or test-taking smarts. Rather, it reflects a broader and deeper capability for comprehending our surroundings, catching on, making sense of things, or figuring out what to do, unquote. The same article contains the following as well. A high IQ is an advantage in life because virtually all activities require some reasoning and decision-making. Conversely, a low IQ is often a disadvantage, especially in disorganized environments. Of course, a high IQ no more guarantees success than a low IQ guarantees failure in life. There are many exceptions, but the odds for success in our society greatly favor individuals with higher IQs. This refers back to what Mr. Entin was saying about IQ and criminality, etc., etc. Now, the article that these two quotes are pulled from was signed by 52 professors, and every single one of them an expert in intelligence or an allied field of science. Neither the concept of race nor the matter of IQ are considered settled by the scientific community. They are, again, hotly debated within the scientific community. It doesn't mean that they don't exist by any stretch of the imagination. Obviously, not only an entire show, but a long-running show dedicated to the topic would be quite easily to produce, and my job is to reduce the pertinent information down to a few bite-sized chunks. As this is an area of interest for me, it's difficult to rein the conversation in. I have not read Entin's book, and have only had the chance to flip through Watson's new book. I have, however, read Richard Lynn's Race Differences and Intelligence, Race, Evolution, and Behavior, A Life History Perspective by J.P. Rushton, and much of the book The Bell Curve, which was highly controversial and made a pretty big name for itself a number of years ago and still continues to be controversial. These and other articles from academic and non-academic sources dealing with race and IQ. I am not a scientist, nor do I claim to have a complete understanding of the subject. I do know that Watson and others have been scapegoated terribly by a biased media. You can search out the Snyderman and Rothman study on Wikipedia as an example of how journalists' views specifically on race and IQ significantly diverge from the opinion of scientists who study the matter. Over 1,000 scientists were interviewed for the study, and it's pretty significant. Go check it out. What many people fear is that if there is a difference in IQ between the races, that it will have significant implications on our society. It would, certainly. But the opposite view that seems to reign among opinion makers is that we are all equal in ability, intelligence, etc., and has had long been implementing their views on society. I would direct you to look up the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education's website, where they draw attention to mandatory re-education sessions at the University of Delaware. Two quotes from the training materials for those who are supposed to be to implement this re-education are as follows. One, a racist is one who is both privileged and socialized on the basis of race by a white supremacist system. The term applies to all white people, i.e., people of European descent, living in the United States, regardless of class, gender, religion, culture, or sexuality. By this definition, people of color cannot be racists, because as people within the U.S. system, they do not have the power to back up their prejudices, hostilities, or acts of discrimination. The second definition they provide is of a non-racist. Quote, a non-term. The term was created by whites to deny responsibility for systematic racism, to maintain an aura of innocence in the face of racial oppression, and to shift responsibility for that oppression from whites to people of color. Responsibility for perpetuating and legitimizing a racist system rests both on those who actively maintain it and those who refuse to challenge it. Silence is consent. So, damned if you do, damned if you don't, basically. And this is a clear example of someone with a politically motivated view of race and implementing that view to forward their political and social goals. These views are informed by the scientists who put forth that race is only a social construct, and in part by obvious Marxist ideology. By their very literal definition, it is impossible for any white person not to be a racist. And conversely, it is impossible for any non-white person to be a racist. Go to the website www.thefire.org and read the documents yourself. What is never separated in public debate is the person who believes there is a taxonomical validity to the concept of race and someone who wants to oppress people of those races other than their own. Race realist or racialist are terms that are used only in small, dare I say, minority circles of people involved in discussing race, and has no hierarchical connotation. Unfortunately, the word racialist is so close in sound to racist that the actual definition and the difference between the definition of the two words wouldn't matter. For example, when David Howard, an aide to the black mayor of Washington, D.C., Anthony Williams, in 1999, used the word niggardly. Now, Howard resigned from his job because the word niggardly, which means stingy or miserly, offended one of his black colleagues, who was clearly ignorant. Another minority group, referred to as the gay community, of which Howard is referred to as being a member of, petitioned for an internal review of the matter. And the mayor did offer Howard the chance to return to his position. I know this is a big digression, and the one positive thing I can say is Julian Bond, who was the chairman of the NAACP, did say that David Howard should not have quit, and that the mayor should order dictionaries be issued to all staff members who need them. Kudos to you, Julian Bond, on that. What's presented is the idea that you are either an evil racist or a good person who denies the very existence of race. Now, this is clearly bullshit, as someone can easily hold the view that races are indeed a taxonomic reality with scientifically measurable differences, but still have no impulse to join the Hammerskins, the Nation of Islam, a follower of Mahatma Gandhi, who has been accused of racism, or to join a Christian, Jewish, or Islamic church, as all three have very ethnocentric proclamations in their core doctrine. One thing that is clear in the above lines is that the so-called anti-racist activists state they don't believe that races exist, but desperately struggle to make endless racial classifications for non-whites to provide them with opportunities they often don't deserve because of non-racial elements. The folks that are so vociferous to accuse others of racism are the very ones who are politicizing race for social and economic advantage. Not that some people don't just get fucked over. No matter what your personal views on the subject are, I encourage skepticism and a strong urge to find a third side, a satanic perspective. As a Satanist, you are not afraid to be bold, nor fear shunning from the mainstream. We don't try to fit in. We are defiantly ourselves, and name-calling doesn't change either A, who you are as a person, or B, the objective reality of the world. There might be subjects impolite to discuss in certain situations, but there is no subject beyond the pale of scientific discussion, contrary to what the Science Museum of London may feel on the subject. Now, with all of that being said, I have a change to make. As I said at the top of the show, some of the opinions expressed here may change. Some of the news reported here may change. That is just the sheer fact of life as it happens. The segment was recorded yesterday on Friday, and today, Saturday, I see a report from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and they state, late Thursday, University of Delaware President Patrick Harker released on the school's website a message to the University of Delaware community, terminating the university's ideological re-education program, which FIRE condemned as an exercise in thought reform. He stated, quote, "I have directed that the program be stopped immediately. No further activities under the current framework will be conducted." Unquote. Harker also called for a, quote, "full and broad-based review," unquote, of the program's practices and purposes. While concerns remain about the University of Delaware's commitment to free expression, FIRE commends President Harker for his decision to immediately terminate the Orwellian Residence Life Education Program. There you go. So the quotes, they existed, they were real, they were in place, and because an organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, took action against them, that has been stopped. So now we will break for some commercials. A little bit past the 25-minute mark, but I do tend to be a little verbose. So enjoy, and I'll be back. I was really planning on making the Watson segment just one of four during this podcast, but the more I talk to other people about it, the more I see that there are some essential points I'm still missing in this discussion, if I'm to present it to you. So, in this half of the episode, I'm going to continue the discussion about James Watson and the race and IQ controversy. People, journalists, including Rebecca Skepchik Watson, keep saying that James Watson is known for his out-there statements. Kooky. But I've really had a hard time tracking anything down that seems to fit that description. Wikipedia does have a few listed, and the one thing I find is, quote, "If you could find the gene which determines sexuality and a woman decides she doesn't want a homosexual child, well, let her." If this is a statement about a mother's right to have an abortion based on her own personal criteria, however controversial her criteria may be to anyone outside of her, then how crazy is that statement? I guess it's that he uses a combination of controversies to make a point of strident libertarianism in regards to abortion, and that upsets people because not only is he speaking out against pro-lifers, but he's mentioning homosexuals as well. It seems to be a matter of how he's expressing himself here over the actual meaning of his message. I'm going to have a hard time believing that Rebecca Watson is pro-life, anti-abortion. So it's how he's presenting his facts or his sentiment. But I could be wrong. When I think of an out-there comment or a kooky comment, I think of reptilian David Icke, or if we're dealing with specifically the race controversy, the go-to guy for an offensive statement would be David Duke. Now, James Watson has also been attributed with saying, quote, "Whenever you interview fat people, you feel bad because you know you're not going to hire them." Now, this speaks of his personal bias against fat people, sure. And I guess he is projecting his personal bias onto others by saying "you" instead of "I," or just trying to absolve himself personally of that type of discrimination. More or less, it's his candor that's gotten himself quoted again. And I guess the idea of not hiring somebody because they're fat is discriminatory. There you go. We got him there. Now, you taking in this and other statements listed on the Wikipedia page with these, it seems to be a pretty sparse and weak collection of controversial quotes for a man so old and supposedly controversial. Maybe I'm missing something that his detractors haven't yet entered into Wikipedia, or that has been brought up in various articles I've read on the subject. I figured if so many people were pulling out the big guns to take down James Watson, they'd unload all their ammunition. Still, it's pretty much just his quote about Africa and employees, and then this fat comment and the aborting a homosexual fetus comment that's really been attributed to him as such a giant controversy. I'd like to relate to you, because it's so compact, blogger Steve Saylor's one-point plan for preventing prejudice in kids. Point number one, don't let your children get beaten up by underclass minorities. Now, liberals can feel safe that their children will not suffer at the hands of unruly minorities, but have them still be enlightened by egalitarian worldviews by sending them to expensive private schools, as they do. To support this claim, in an article on VDare.com, he quotes Howard Kurtz from a 1994 issue of the Columbia Journalism Review, who said, quote, "Equally revealing was the media response to the Clintons' announcement that they were sending their daughter, Chelsea, to Sidwell Friends, an $11,000 a year private school in Northwest Washington. When columnist Mark Shields praised Sidwell on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, he had to note that his children went there, as did Jim Lehrer's and Judy Woodruff's husband. Al Hunt made a similar disclosure while defending Clinton on Capital Gang. Carl Rowan touted Sidwell on Inside Washington, pointing out that his grandchildren attended the school. Howard Fineman, whose daughter was in kindergarten at Sidwell, said he, quote, shamelessly lobbied the Clintons to choose the school. The major difference that I see between Watson's anecdotal comment that you can see how blacks have lower average IQs from having to work with them as employees, and Entine's comments that Jews make good lawyers and comedians is that one of them is referring to an out-group and the other an in-group. Similar to the frustration both blacks and whites have found in the in-group usage of the word nigger to the out-group use. The latter being publicly verboten expression and the former being touted as culturally empowering or at least just written off because black people should be able to refer to themselves by whatever language they want. But that in itself obviously has been a recent controversy and there have been calls for everybody to stop using the term. Watson might have failed to express his anecdotal evidence in an appealing way, but so did my favorite waitress at a now-closed restaurant around the corner from my old apartment when she said, "I don't like to wait on black people. They don't tip." She was a black woman, and however racist it sounds, there's even been a discussion on the phenomenon on NPR. Google the tipping divide, or you can just type in why black people don't tip. Does tipping have a genetic basis? I don't know. That's the whole different discussion about genes and altruism, evolutionary psychology, and biology, etc. Another crime that James Watson is supposedly guilty of is expressing a politicized opinion. I hardly think his comments, as he framed them, amount to a politicized opinion so much, but even if you construe them as such, it's a very weak way to present a political opinion compared to a number of eminent scientists that have held contrary views. One of the most respected popularizers of science and evolution, Stephen Jay Gould, was a founding member of the radical left-wing activist organization called Science for the People. Gould is one of the most frequently referenced scientists, from my personal reading, in the mainstream media when evolution is referenced, at least up until the last few years when other writers have gotten a bit more notoriety, such as Richard Dawkins. But it was Gould that taught a course at Harvard entitled Biology as a Social Weapon. If that ain't politicizing science, I don't know what is. And as much as I'd like to comment on Gould's concept of non-overlapping magisteria, now that would be way too much of a digression, even for me. Another comment made to me by someone who listened to an unfinished version of this show was asking me to clarify what the actual scientific consensus is. I did say at the beginning of this show that I didn't want to get into the science so much as just discuss the controversy, but I think it is a valid question. I will at least touch on it and suggest that if you're interested, you should follow up on it. I always suggest that people remain skeptic of everything that they hear. Skeptic of my claims, skeptic of the church, skeptic of everything. Find out for your fucking self. Some very august scientific bodies have come out both for and against the book The Bell Curve. Since this book was a lightning rod for the very similar controversy of race and IQ, you can look the book up in Wikipedia, a site that I use often but take with a large dose of skepticism as well, and that'll give you a starting point along with an article on race and intelligence they have there. One common cry is books like The Bell Curve and comments like the ones Watson made in his book and interview is that they are fueling racism or of the nature of what's called scientific racism. The latter is a political term and I feel most often used by people with political agendas. Most ironic is these people with political agendas apply the term scientific racism to any views they feel are themselves politicizing race in a way counter to their own views, and therefore kind of a pot kettle black situation, no pun intended. The idea that the bell curve fuels racism, I see as a problem with the previously mentioned lack of common public distinction between the general understanding of the term racist, with all its malicious implications, and a racialist or race realist that has no hierarchical connotations or implicit hatred or fear of outgroups. The folks who use both of these charges are often invested in there not being a distinction between the two, because they want to maintain the idea that there is no such thing as race in the first place. So if they allow for any kind of distinction between somebody who is, you know, a hateful racist and somebody who just believes in a scientific category, a taxonomical category of race, then they've got a problem because people can be less emotional about it. There was a task force established by the Board of Scientific Affairs at the American Psychological Association to investigate the book, The Bell Curve. The task force came out in support of the predictive validity of IQ in school and occupational achievement, that individual differences in IQ were influenced by both genetics and environment, that only severe malnutrition seems to influence IQ in childhood, and that there is no significant difference in IQ between the sexes. In regard to the race gap in IQ between whites and blacks, it boils down to the line, quote, "At present, no one knows what causes the differential." Somebody might know, but they're not giving scientific legitimacy to any claim, basically. The debate is ongoing, obviously, and both sides feature figures that have a clear bias, and some that don't. We don't necessarily know if these biases are pre-existing, such as possibly in the case of Stephen Jay Gould's long-standing association with Marxist and leftist groups, or are the result of scientific discovery. Certainly, if you come to a conclusion from scientific evidence, you'll base judgments on that in other areas of your life. I'm not implying that Watsons are either one, but neither the hereditarians nor the environmentalists are in the clear for purely objective scientific disclosure. Since I did mention these two schools, I would like to just ponder with you the mind-bendingly counterintuitive leap that is made in these two different classifications. These are common names for two embattled positions within the debate over the source of human nature and character traits. Hereditarian is a bit of a misnomer, as people consider it analogous with pure genetic determinism. Noam Chomsky is a hereditarian, but he breaks from the school when it comes to race in the IQ debate. Hereditarian just means that you believe that genes play a role in human nature and the development of individuation. Now, the standard social science model, social determinism, or environmentalism, are different names for the concept that there is no genetic basis that creates individuation in human behavior. They differ slightly, but they all pretty much refer to some aspect of the environment playing the only role in making us different. Now, what is so counterintuitive about this is the majority of hereditarians are portrayed by mainstream media and environmentalists as holding an extremist position. This is counterintuitive because almost no hereditarian believes that heredity accounts for all the differences in human traits, and that environmental factors can have a significant effect on human diversity. It's just that the environment isn't the sole contributor. It's a balance of the nature and the nurture, and each can have varying degrees of impact depending on what trait you're talking about. Hair and skin color is obviously highly determined by genes, but what language you speak is highly environmental. Of course, Neither of these two illustrations are really in controversy, but IQ, criminality, athletic ability, etc. are. It is actually the blank slate view, this environmental model that actually is the extreme one, because it believes that genes play no role at all in determining things like behavior, IQ, and other character traits. They would say that there are few good black quarterbacks in the NFL because of purely social or environmental reasons, whereas a hereditarian may say that there are certain aspects of that position that whites who dominate the quarterback position have a predisposition to be better at. On the converse, there are, I believe, no white starting running backs in the NFL. They're all black. And maybe there's something about the demands of that position that blacks in general, the higher echelons of athletics, are just able to compete better at than whites. The same would be true for the reason that Ethiopians and Kenyans dominate the 5 and 10K meter male Olympic running events. Ethiopia had 60 athletes in the 2004 Summer Olympics. Two of those 60 were boxers, and all 58 others were in track and field events. Now, I'll buy that rowing is a sport that needs water, a boat, and some oars, and a team of people. There are environmental factors that have to be part of the training. But running long distances seems to be open to pretty much anyone able to put one leg in front of the other and have some sort of expanse to run across. Besides very small islands, I think this pretty much leaves it all up to pure ability at that point. There's certainly no cultural bias against running long distances here in the United States. We certainly have highly celebrated marathons. The question is, are you willing to rule out the possibility that there's something innate to Kenyans and Ethiopians that gives them an advantage in this sport? Or do you believe that a Central African pygmy hasn't had the environmental or social advantage that West African Kenyans have had to develop an Olympic track and field team? I will give the last word on the subject to Ernst Mayr from his book, What Evolution Is, a fantastic book about evolution, and I highly recommend you picking it up if you need to go over the basics. He answers the question, are there human races? When one compares an Inuit with an African Bushman, or a Nilotic Negro, an Australian Aborigine, a Chinese, or a blonde, blue-eyed Northern European, one cannot escape recognizing the so-called racial differences. But does this not conflict with our fervent belief in human equality? No, it does not, provided we define both equality and race properly. Equality is a civic equality. It means equality before the law, and it means equal opportunity, but it does not mean total identity, because we now know that every one of the 6 billion human individuals is genetically unique. Not every human has the mathematical ability of an Einstein or the speed of an Olympic sprinter, nor the imagination of a good novelist or the aesthetic sense of an outstanding painter. Every parent knows that each of his or her children is uniquely different. The time has come that we must honestly face and admit these differences. What is important is to realize that these differences also exist within all of the human races. The major reason for the existence of a race problem is that so many people have a faulty understanding of race. These people are typologists, and for them, every member of a race has all the actual and imaginary characteristics of that race. To translate this bias into an absurd example, they would assume that every African American can run the 100-meter dash faster than any European American. Yet, If in a racially mixed class in a school, the students were seated according to their performance in various mental, physical, manual, and artistic challenges, each ranking would be different and each race would be distributed through a greater part of the ranking. In other words, by rejecting the typological approach, which considers the members of each race as a type, and replacing it by the populational approach in which each individual is considered on the basis of his or her particular abilities, a truer understanding of reality can be achieved that avoids any typological ranking and any discrimination based on such ranking. And that is how Ernst Mayr responds. There is no God. This statement is not meant to shock, certainly not listeners of Satanism Today. It's not meant to offend or bully listeners of this podcast. Hopefully it does stop some people from listening to this podcast, because if they have such strong objections to that, I don't want them listening to my voice. I suspect, though, that after the first half, if there are people listening, the idea of there being no God is probably not their biggest objection to anything I've said. The main objective of me just stating that clearly is so that it is absolutely unequivocating that this one idea informs every single word that I say. The idea that there is no God is the basis of my thought. I don't go from thinking that there is any supernatural power involved in any decision I make. A brain guided by the belief in a God or some other supernatural force may say very similar words to the ones that I say, but their words will always have the added stain of imbecility that is theism, especially if they attribute their God to one of the major religious bodies. Consider this to be my form of a public service announcement. And now on to other things. Now it's the time for the interview. And in fact, I've decided to do an ambush interview. This is where I go through my cell phone and pick phone numbers of people that you might want to hear interviewed, or I just want to talk to, and I see who I can get on the horn. Here we go. Call number one.
No one's home right now. Leave a message and we'll get back to you. Bye.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Jack Malibranch, this is Kevin Slaughter. Just giving you a call, nothing important. Just going to try to do an ambush interview with you for Satanism Today, which I'm hosting this week. But that's the secret until we announce it, and I'm pre-recording the show. So, get back to me if you want to do a short, say, you know, 5-10 minute interview, and we can just shoot the shit about what's going on. All right, thanks, bye.
You have reached the Sprint PCS voicemail box of 1-889-9635. To leave a voice message, press 1, or just wait for the tone. To send a numeric page, press 2 now. At the tone, please record your voice message. When you are finished recording, you may hang up or press pound for more options.
Stephen Kasner, this is Kevin Slaughter. Just giving you a call, see how things are going. All right, well, get back to me at your leisure. Just want to say hi. Bye-bye.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
Christopher Miali
is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. To leave a callback number, press 5.
Chris, this is Kevin giving you a call. Got your email. Figured I would give you a ring and see if you were available to chat for a few minutes. But I guess not. All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hello?
Hello. Is Artie available?
Who's this?
This is Kevin Slaughter. Artie?
Of course, yeah.
Oh, it didn't sound like you.
Your name didn't pop up on my phone, so I was like, it's from Baltimore. It could be either really good news or really bad news.
So do you give your consent to be recorded?
Sir, have you made any purchases at Nordstrom's or Macy's recently?
Yeah. No, I'm actually, I actually am recording you for a... radio show. It's not live. It's being pre-recorded.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah. So, so what do you think about that?
I think it's great.
Good.
I'm totally giving my permission.
Yeah, yeah. I'm guest hosting Satanism Today.
Okay.
Did you ever send in your membership money by any chance?
No, mainly because I've succumbed to the sin of
sloth. Oh, okay. Okay.
It's my only defense is that I have the money.
Yeah.
I have the desire.
Yeah.
I haven't been motivated enough to get it done.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That's perfectly acceptable. So, Artie Philly.
Yes.
I'm doing an ambush interview with you.
Oh, cool. Okay.
I don't know if I don't know if the listeners may know who the Artie Philly is. Some people live in a closet. I know you've been in the closet for a very long time.
That's true.
Howard, you're a bit of a minstrel.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
That's fair.
The Shemps. How is the Shemps doing?
The Shemps are, functioning at our usual capacity, which is handicapped. But we do our thing. We play. We make enemies, and then we move on to another place and do the same. So we have a whole album worth of material that we just haven't been able to get together to finish, and like half recorded, and we can't agree on artwork, and usually we have long conversations about it that go nowhere, and then we just wind up drinking and forgetting to get anything done. So, we're proceeding at the usual pace of a punk rock band, I think.
Well, good. Good to hear. Celebrity Murders, still alive and well?
Yeah, we're actually playing a lot more than we used to. Like, we replaced our guitarist, who is just kind of, got preoccupied with personal stuff, and he quit, and we got a new guy, and now we're able to play more shows and stuff, and we actually have a bunch of shows coming up, which is, we've played more this year. We played more in the last, 3 months than we've played, in all of 2006, so that's a good sign, and we have a lot of new stuff, too, and, we're doing our thing.
Do you have any shows coming up after the 8th that in that vicinity?
Yeah, we're playing on the 17th of November with a band called Government Warning, who I guess, the kids like, and some other bands, Splitting Headache, and I forget the other band. But we're playing at ABC Rio in New York City, which is kind of a regular haunt for us. The fact that it's still standing is pretty impressive. The place is a real unique building, a unique touchstone in DIY culture in New York City. It's an affectionate way of putting it.
Well, just a fount of background information. By the way, I did forget to ask, do you have a few minutes to talk?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Philadelphia, actually. I'm not far from you. I'm on a job. So.
I won't inquire further.
Probably better for both of us. So how's it going?
It's going pretty well. You're going to follow a really big discussion on race. So.
Oh, okay.
So that you're definitely going to. Not a lot of people are going to be listening to the show at this point, anyway. So feel free to.
I'm hoping this will be edited somewhat.
I'm not sure. I've got about I got about 15 minutes of time to fill, and I see we're at about 12 minutes. I might hang up the phone pretty quickly.
Okay. Did you say race or wraith?
Race, RACE. James Watson. Are you familiar with the recent James Watson? He's the Nobel laureate who was fired from his job at Cold Spring Laboratories.
Not intimately familiar. I didn't really. Read in detail about the situation, but I know the basics, and I kind of have an odd sort of third-person acquaintance with the guy.
You actually, that's true. What a great little tie. You've got a friend works at Cold Spring Laboratory.
Won't
name him.
That's his 9-to-5. He's a tech, an IT guy there, and he's a regular. He knows all the scientists that work there and stuff, and they're a weird bunch, including Watson. They just sort of have weird scientist get togethers, and they do scientist things. There was a scientist Halloween party the other day where one of the dudes that works there, I guess, dressed up like Nano and covered himself in balloons and hung a little sign on him that said Nano. Scientists are kind of a unique bunch.
That's pretty incredible.
They have fun in weird ways, and I guess his idea of a good Halloween joke in context of the situation that's going on would have been to dress up as Africa, to wear a big like a cardboard sort of cut out of a map of Africa and just sort of walk into walls all night, you know, and be in character and like have a glass of water and be like, I'm really thirsty, and spill the glass of water on the ground, you know. So we got a good laugh out of that, but he didn't actually follow through with it, probably because he would have been fired.
Yeah, they seem to be doing that recently, firing.
There's a lot of that going around.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of that.
So, yeah, I'm familiar with that. I mean, I'm not sure what insight I can lend beyond that ridiculousness.
Sure, sure. Well, that's good enough. I mean, I didn't call you. I didn't call you to get your opinions on the subject. And you can just, you know, listen to the podcast on podcast on Thursday, and you can hear my thoughts on the subject and just adopt those as your own.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Artie Philly. And
well, it's always good to hear from you. You know, I miss hanging out with you, and hope everything's going well.
Okay.
Right, give my regards to Ida and everybody else.
I will. Thank you, sir.
No problem.
And
take
goodbye.
Care, bye.
The great thing about going through my list of friends is anyone who I was going to call would have been great to talk to and would have had something very interesting to say for you to listen to. Also, upon listening to the sections, I really like the sound of the music and the phone ringing. It's really moody. Anyway, I digress. I do have to wrap the show up, but I have recorded another 20 minutes or so of discussion on James Watson and the race and the IQ controversy, and that will be available in the podcast, the downloadable podcast version of the show. But I've got about 30 seconds here to plug the Church of Satan, the Satanic Scriptures, the Satanic
two.